We think about our country's history as well as the history of many nations. A lot of times we record great things in song. You think even in our nation of the numerous songs that record things about great men and great events, even to our own national anthem that records this battle that took place where at the end of the battle the Americans had stood strong. When we go to the Bible, there's not a lot of difference with that. We may not find the same things commemorated. But yet in the Bible, we find a number of songs being given that tell us of very great things, that tell us of events that have happened, and sometimes songs which tell us of events that are going to happen. Such is the case when we look at Isaiah chapter 35. Here in this particular passage, we have a song that's recorded for us. Now, the Lord did not give us a title to that song, but I would say if I had to come up with a title for it, I might entitle it the Remnant's Song. We understand that at that time, there were a number of people who were troubled by things that were happening. They looked at their nation, they looked at the things that were taking place, and they were troubled not only by that, but the judgment that God was promising that was going to come. That one day, and it wasn't going to be too far from this time, that God would bring that judgment on His people because of their sin. But yet the righteous needed something to hope in. The righteous needed something that they could look forward to. And the prophets, Isaiah included, are replete with that idea of God saying, judgment's coming, but for those of you who are righteous, better times are coming as well. Such is the case as in Isaiah chapter 35. However, Isaiah is one of those books that oftentimes when you look at a passage, you see somewhat of a dual meaning, a short-term and a long-term prophecy being given. Because not only is the Lord telling the remnant to hang on, to realize that better days will come, but He's also prophesying of a time when the best days will come, when the Lord will come forth and we, the remnant of God's people in this day and age, can have the same hope, even a better hope, because of the things that God will provide. This morning, I want us to talk about Isaiah 35. We're going to talk some in the context of the remnant of Israel's day. But the major focus this morning will be the message that it has for us. The things that you and I can gain as far as encouragement of hanging on for better times to come. If we were to think about this chapter as far as breaking it up into stanzas, some have suggested that it would be like this, that we would have the first couple of verses, stanza 1, on down through verse 10 being stanza 7. This morning, we're going to kind of use this outline as we go through it. However, I'm not going to go in chronological order here. We're going to be looking at three specific ideas and be looking at the verses and the stanzas that will support these ideas. And as we think about these ideas, one of the first that I think we need to establish very early on, that the writer here is telling us, that the Lord is telling us, is that when we think about the remnant song, we need to understand that a sinner is finding the Lord. Now to fully understand that, we need to go back and think about sin for a minute. As we think about a sinner rejoicing in the fact that he's finding a Lord, what would bring that rejoicing? Well, the first thing I want us to consider this morning is just a reminder that sin absolutely ruined everything. We don't have to go too far in the Bible to find that, do we? In fact, look with me over to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3. I trust you're familiar with the creation account and the fall of man as Adam and Eve sinned. And as God is dealing with that sin, as He's talking about the consequences to come, I want us to note what He says down in verses 17 and 18. It says, "Then to Adam He said, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you. And you shall eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." Consider what sin did. Here when man was created, he was placed in paradise. When we talk about the Garden of Eden, it wasn't just a nice place with a lot of nice trees around. It was God's presence. It was paradise. Man and woman could freely associate, freely talk with God. But sin brought an end to all of that. And to illustrate what God, how He views sin, what He did was He took this state of Eden, this state of perfection, and He brought in the thorns, and He brought in the thistles, and in that He gave a very visual aid to Adam and Eve. Here is what sin can do. Here is how sin can take a paradise and bring it to ruin. This was not the natural way things should have been. Things should have been like they were in Eden as God created it. But because of sin's presence, that was gone. And I would suggest to us that as we consider that, we need to understand that that's what sin does to our own lives. That you and I were not created to be sinful people, contrary to what a lot of our religious friends would tell us. You and I are not created from the standpoint of being born with sin or some kind of fatalism where we've got to sin. No, that's not how we were created. But yet in our weaknesses, that's what we allowed to come into our lives. Rather than staying faithful, rather than staying truthful to God, we allow sin to come in. And just as sin caused the change from paradise to thorns, so it changes what God has created as something beautiful into something that is very ugly. Isn't that what James tells us? James says in chapter 4, verse 17, "To him who knows to do good, but does not do it, to him it is sin." To the one who knows the right thing to do, the godly thing to do, but chooses to do something else, that's what sin's all about. But yet, as we think about the ugliness of sin, as we think about the mar that sin makes on our own lives, what it transforms us into, aren't we fortunate when we think about the fact that we have a God who provides a way of escape? A God who provides a way out of this mess that we've gotten ourselves into. As we think about that point, look back with me to Isaiah chapter 35. If you've not done so yet, you may just want to drop your marker here. We'll be coming back and forth from this chapter as we think about these thoughts this morning. As we look at chapter 35, look with me to verses 1 and 2. He says, "The wilderness and the wasteland shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. It shall blossom abundantly and rejoice, even with joy and singing. The glory of Lebanon shall be given to it, the excellence of Carmel and Sharon." As we consider this particular section of the song, I think it would do us quite well to put this in the context of the day in which it was written. If you've done very much study of the prophets, you remember that as you're reading through Isaiah, or really most any of the other prophets, there will be many times when God will say, "When the day of the Lord comes." And when He uses that phrase almost all of the time, He is talking about a time of national judgment that's going to be brought on a nation. Now sometimes He's talking about Israel, and sometimes He's talking about Judah, and sometimes He's talking about Edom and Babylon and Assyria, but it's always about a nation that's going to be brought down. Not an end of the world kind of judgment, but an end of their world kind of judgment. The fact that their nation is going to be taken and turned upside down. And oftentimes when we read about that national judgment that's being brought, it's going to be followed with a number of very interesting pictures. God will say, "The day of the Lord will come, the sun will be darkened, the moon will be turned to blood, the stars will fall from the skies." Now, we've had people who've tried to take that language and draw us all kinds of pictures of how we're going to know when the end of time comes. But it's very much doing damage to those verses to treat them in that way. God is using very symbolic language to say to these nations, everything that you trust in Everything that you think is normal, I'm going to take away because of the sin that you've done. Now put yourself in an Israelite's position. Here you have read the prophets. You've heard them speak that language of the sun being taken out and the moon being destroyed, and you understand that that's about national judgment. And then you're given this song, where in verses 1 and 2, everything that is wrong is being made right. Everything that is abnormal is being made normal once again. And as God draws that picture, He talks about wilderness and wasteland bursting forth in flowers, trees coming up, paradise, if you will, returning. Why? Because the Lord can take what we have made ugly and He can make it beautiful once again. Now, what about us? What about us? When we read this passage, is there anything for us to glean from it in this day and age? I think as well we can understand that in our own personal salvation that the same principle is there. That when we have made our lives ugly with sin, when we have taken what is beautiful and ruined it by sin, God has full ability to make it right again. And I direct us down to verse 5. And I want you to listen to what these verses say. He says, "Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, and the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. For waters shall burst forth in the wilderness, and streams to the in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water. In the habitation of jackals where each lay, there shall be grass with reeds and rushes." When you look at verses 5 and 6, what comes to your mind? As we think about eyes being opened and ears being unstopped and lame people walking once again, does that not draw us to the time of the Messiah? Are we not immediately brought in our minds to the time when Jesus comes upon the earth and He is going to those who have these problems and returning them back to the way that it's supposed to be? Eyes are supposed to see, ears are supposed to hear, legs are supposed to walk. And for those who could not carry out the functions, they were given that ability once again. Certainly, the messianic undertones are obvious. But there's something I want us to note. Just as Christ made these physical things right once again, that's what He will do for mankind spiritually. Things that are not working the way they're supposed to, He'll put them in order once again. And it's interesting as we look through the Bible that that theme runs almost constantly. That spiritually, God is going to make things right for us. Look with me, if you will, to Psalm 41. I'd like for us to look at two or three passages just to kind of get a feel for this thought and to see that it is found throughout the Bible. Psalm 41, look with me to verse 4. Psalm 41, verse 4. Here David writing, he says, "I said, Lord, be merciful to me. Heal my soul, for I have sinned against You." Notice his language there. Notice what he says. As he talks about being right with God, there's that healing being brought up. Notice another psalm with me. Go over this time to Psalm 6. And as we note in Psalm 6, we'll go down to verse 2. And I want us to note here, again a psalm of David, what he says, begging the Lord's forgiveness in this psalm. He says, "Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am weak. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are troubled." Now I ask you, in either of those passages, is David praying for physical health? Has David got a cold? Has he come down with the flu? Is that what he's praying for? Wouldn't be wrong for him to pray for those things, but that's not the idea. He's saying to the Lord in both of these places, I am sick because of sin. I have been brought down because of the ugliness that has entered my life. And I look to you for healing. Note one other passage with me. This time going to another of the prophets over in Jeremiah. We go to chapter 3 of the book of Jeremiah, and as we listen to what he has to say to the people of his day, notice the advice that he gives them. Of course, this is coming from the Lord. Jeremiah writing these things down from the Lord's mouth. He says in verse 22, "Return, you backsliding children, and I will heal your backslidings." Now, we could go on. But what do we find in these passages? We find the idea that God can make things right. That which is sick can be made well. It's also of great interest to me as we consider Isaiah 35, that he talks about the restoration being brought forth in terms of water. If you look back to chapter 35, going down to the very last part of verse 6, he says, "The waters shall burst forth in the wilderness and streams in the desert. The parched ground shall become a pool, and the thirsty land springs of water." Have you ever taken any time to study water in the Bible? You ever taken time just to look at the number of times and the number of occasions that water plays an important role? We think about the crossing of the Red Sea. We think about the waters of Marah. We think about the crossing of the Jordan. Throughout the Bible, water has symbolized power. And such is the case here. As Isaiah draws this picture for us, sings this song for us, as he talks about restoration, he talks about the impact that water is going to have in that. And it's of great interest when we come to the New Testament, the importance that water is given. We think about passages like 1 Peter 3:21. There is namely an antitype which now does save us. Baptism. We think about Acts 2:38. We think about Mark 16:16. We think about the book of Acts. Conversion, conversion, conversion. It's always water, isn't it? There is a change of heart and a baptism for a remission of sin. How do you and I become beautiful once again in God's sight? How do you and I once again return to the condition that we were supposed to be in? It's by coming to the Lord in faith and saying that I trust that you can wash away my sins, as the Apostle Paul said of his own sins, in the waters of baptism. God can restore. And a sinner who finds the Lord is going to find Him by the restoration of sins being removed through the washing away of baptism. God makes things right. God can make us what we need to be. And the remnant sings that we have found the Lord. What else? I would say another theme that we find running in this song is this. Amongst this remnant, there was an idea of waiting for the Lord. Again, another interesting phrase to kind of look through in the Bible, to find the number of times God says to wait on Him. This time, however, I want us to look back to chapter 35, back to verse 2. And as we look down to the latter part of this verse, stanza 2, we might say, of the song here, notice what the remnant is saying, or what's being said about them. It says, "They shall see the glory of the Lord, the excellency of our God." For those who trust God, they have tasted His glory. For those who trust God, they have tasted His graciousness. But I think, as you and I well know, if we are children of God, there is a longing to know more than just what we can know here. There is a longing to see God face to face. And whether you are a remnant in the nation of Israel, or whether you are a remnant now amongst this sinful world, there is a longing to look upon God's face, to have that fellowship that is uninhibited, to have a fellowship that was experienced just like Adam and Eve had prior to their sins. Does God allow that to happen? Well, He says to the remnant, one day, that's going to happen. But until then, you've got to wait patiently. And the thing about the Lord is He doesn't just leave it at that. He doesn't just say, well, you've got to wait on me and that's it. He gives encouragement. And He says, while that time of waiting is taking place, there are things that I want you to consider. And as we look here in the song once again, look with me to verses 3 and 4, stanza 3 of the song. He says, strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who are fearful hearted, be strong, do not fear. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. With the recompense of God, He will come and save you. In those two verses, there's a lot of meat. In those two verses, God is saying, for those who are looking for Me, for those who are waiting for Me, who are seeking My face, I provide encouragement for you. I think that's found in verse 3 and the first part of verse 4. Where God is saying to them, hang on a little bit longer. Stay strong a little bit longer. He says, for those of you who have weak hands, strengthen them. I always imagine a runner who's just crossed the finish line when I think about this passage. I have never been much into running. But for those who enjoy it, there is a thrill of finishing, going over that finish line, but for every runner I've talked to, there is also almost an instantaneous exhaustion. The race is run, and immediately the hands fall down. God says, are you feeling that way? Are you feeling like all the energy's drained out of you? Are you exhausted? Strengthen those weak hands. Understand that the Lord has expectations for you to work here. He doesn't expect for you just to lay down and sleep. He doesn't expect for you just to sit and wait. He says, strengthen your hands and get to work in the things that I need you to do. He says, do you have weak knees? Is it hard for you to stand up? Are you so tired you feel like that you're just bearing a burden beyond what you're capable? He says, firm up those weak knees. I'll give you the stability you need. You see, when we trust in God, we understand that God is going to give us no more than we're able to bear. And He says to those who are waiting for Him, stand strong because I'm with you. He says, is your heart feeling a little weak? Are you fearful hearted? I think about Rahab's statement. You remember? As she describes when the Israelites are coming, she says, our hearts melted within us because of the God says, are you fearful hearted? Remember who you're standing with. Remember your conviction. And when you do that, you can stand strong. All of this is an encouragement for us, for them, to remember what God can do. Take just a minute with me and look over to Hebrews chapter 12. The writer here picks up this phrase, as is oftentimes used in the Bible. The idea of the hands and the knees and the heart. We find that many times. Notice what the writer here in Hebrews chapter 12 has to say though. Verse 12, he says, therefore strengthen the knees, or strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Same idea we looked at previously. God says, I am with you. I am going to provide for you. But He doesn't stop there. He says, for those of you who are waiting, there are other things that I want you to know, besides the fact that I'll be with you. He says, also, I'm going to provide answers for you. There's a phrase that's used here in the chapter. If you look back down to where we were reading in verse 4, about halfway through, the verse says, behold, your God will come with vengeance, and with the recompense of God, he will come and save you. Now, when it comes to original language, I am dependent on somebody who knows that, because I don't. But from what I have read, what this verse actually ought to say is this: behold your God. Period. Or maybe exclamation point. Why do I say that? Because what I think God is trying to get across to them here is, you're waiting, you may feel weak, you may feel feeble, you may feel fearful. And when those things happen, behold your God. Isn't that the advice we need? When things are going bad for us in our life, don't we just need to stand back and behold God and say, I've trusted in Him before, He's never let me down. Why would He let me down this time? That's what Israel had to understand. That's what we've got to understand. But He also says when we behold Him, that there are going to be things that He'll do. And one of the things that He says is, I'm going to bring vengeance. I'm going to bring vengeance because of your suffering. Can you imagine a faithful Israelite? Here you are, you've tried to follow the law. You've tried to do what God said. You've tried to give Him your heart. And all you're hearing from His prophets is the day of the Lord's coming, judgment's coming. Wouldn't there be a temptation just to throw up your hands and say, well, if all of this is going to happen, why should I keep on? Especially if you're suffering. Especially if the people of God, and I'm putting that in quotes, are punishing you because you're staying faithful. God says, I'll provide answers to you. I'm going to let you understand that I will bring vengeance for your suffering. In fact, let's go over just a few chapters in the book of Isaiah to chapter 59. Isaiah chapter 59. Look down with me to verse 17. This is, wherever I'm studying in Isaiah, I say is my favorite place, but this one stands pretty firm. I like coming to this passage. Because here we have a picture of the warrior God. If we ever feel like God's not strong enough to take care of us, this is a good passage to come to. Notice, though, what he says. We're just going to read verse 17. It says, for he put on righteousness as a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head. He put on the garments of vengeance for clothing, and was clad with the zeal as a cloak. God here is pictured as a warrior. In fact, Ephesians 6 draws a whole lot of its emphasis from this passage. Here God is putting on His armor because He says, I couldn't find a man who could do it. And He says, I'm going to go out in vengeance. Why? To repay those who have caused my people to suffer. To pay those who have caused problems for my people. We come to the New Testament, 1 Thessalonians. We look over to this passage. That should say 2 Thessalonians on the screen there. 2 Thessalonians chapter 1. And I guess as we look at this passage, it is one of the most pulled out of context passages there is. Because we come to it to describe hell, to describe God's judgment, and we can. But if we look at the context of the passage, it's vengeance. He's telling the people of Thessalonica, don't worry. God's got things under control. These people who are persecuting you, they are going to see the vengeance of God. And as we look here in verse 5, we're picking up in mid-thought. He says, which is manifest evidence of the righteous judgment of God, that you may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God for which you also suffer. Since it is a righteous thing with God to repay with tribulation those who trouble you, and to give you who are troubled rest with us when the Lord Jesus is revealed from heaven with His mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on those who do not know God and on those who do not obey the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ. To the people of Thessalonica, wait on the Lord. Wait on the Lord. Things are rough. People are persecuting you for your faith. Better times are coming. And those who are causing these problems to you will not get away with it. And we add Romans 12:19, where God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." Now, does that mean you and I just sit around and we kind of pump our arms in the air when we think, "All right, these people are going to get it. Those people who are causing us grief, they're going to get it." No. No. I think that's why God says vengeance is off limits to you. You just don't know how to handle it. But it is encouragement to understand that the right will be vindicated. That those who have fought against the Lord will meet the Lord and will be answered for what they've done. And the second thing that he tells them, I believe, is indicated in that. Retribution will be given. Those who have fought against me, they will pay. Hebrews 10:29-30 pretty well spells that out for us. God says, I'm going to give you answers. But first of all, remember who I am. Then remember, vengeance belongs to me. Retribution will be given. Don't worry. Wait on the Lord. And I would say as well, and perhaps the main point that we want to get at today, is that salvation is going to come. And as we look to the end of verse 4 of Isaiah 35, what do we find there? With the recompense of God, He will come and save you. While retribution, vengeance is given for those who fight against the Lord, a reward is waiting for those who are faithful to Him. The sinner will find his God. Salvation will be given to those who wait on the Lord. The final thought I'd like for us to look at this morning from this particular song is that God is going to provide. When you and I look to the Lord, we're looking to the One who can give us what's needed. Here in Isaiah chapter 35, look at verse 8 with me once again. He says, "A highway shall be there and a road, and it shall be called the highway of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it, but it shall be for others. Whoever walks the road, although a fool, shall not go astray." God says, I'm going to provide a highway of holiness. Do you notice that the destination isn't given? We're not told where the highway leads to. I think the Lord is saying, I believe you can figure that one out. When He talks about the highway of holiness, it is taking us to Him. That's what holiness is. Holiness is God. And if you and I are going to be godly, we must in turn be holy. And God says, I provide this for you. And it goes along with the numerous times that we find roads being mentioned in the Bible. It's the path that's chosen by those who are righteous. Go with me over to Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 3, and we'll just get a feel for this. As He talks about roads, as He talks about highways, as He talks about paths that lead to God, here as the Lord is being prophesied concerning the work of John the Baptist, we look in verse 3, and it says, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God." Look at a different idea. Presented over in Jeremiah chapter 6. Jeremiah chapter 6, as we find a different view of the path of the road. Look at what he says in verse 16. "Thus says the Lord, stand in the ways and see, and ask for the old paths where the good way is, and walk in it. Then you will find rest for your souls." But they say, "We will not walk." We look to Matthew chapter 7, and there we read about the straight and the narrow, as we call it. The path that leads to heaven. But in all of these things, where does that road lead? It leads to God. It leads to the One who can provide for us. And as Isaiah goes on to say in his song, there is absolutely nothing on that path that's going to threaten us. If you look back to verse 9 of chapter 35, he says, "No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast go upon it. It shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there." As we consider that, we understand that God has given us redemption. It's an interesting term that's used. If I understand correctly, the term that's used here in Isaiah is the same word that's used to talk about the next of kin taking care of the family member who can't care for himself or herself. Here is the term, the next of kin, coming in and providing the needs that cannot be met on one's own. That's what God is doing for us. He's taking the helpless plight and making it His own. And as Paul would tell us over in Titus chapter 2, in verse 14, that it's the redemption that God is going to provide. What does the Lord provide for us? He provides a way to holiness. He provides a way to Him so that we can escape the grasp of sin. So that we can escape the path of wickedness. Go to the paths of holiness. And how do the righteous react to this? As God provides this highway of holiness, how do those who are faithful? Well, it's no surprise that in a song that's describing this, the righteous come singing. They come singing to Zion with grief and pain, being replaced with holiness and righteousness and joy. And for the remnant of Isaiah's day, what a message that would have been. That while things look bleak and bad, better days are coming. And how even much more so for us. When we think about being a remnant surrounded by an evil world, that a song is coming from our hearts praising God for the fact that He has given us a God to trust in. That He's given us a reason to wait. And that He's given us hope that He'll provide. In light of all of these things, my question is, do we know the song? As you and I consider ourselves, do we know the song that God provides the faithful remnant? I thank you so much for your good attention this morning. Go ahead and get your songbooks out and turn to the number that's been announced. If Isaiah were standing here this morning, he would encourage us to pay attention to the ideas that he's given us. He would encourage us to say, look, it's time to make a change. It's time to get into the family of God, to be righteous, to be faithful to the Lord, to trust that God can provide. This morning, in a sense, Isaiah is standing with us in the fact that we have his word recorded, as well as Paul, Peter, the other apostles, and the Lord himself. Saying the way to salvation is to trust that God can provide. The way to salvation is to believe that when you are baptized, coming with a right heart, your sins are washed away. Are you ready to do that this morning? To put all the excuses aside, all of the things that have kept you from obeying God, to put them away and to obey Him. Or if you've done that and you've fallen from the highway of holiness, you've allowed things to lead you off the path to God, that you're ready to get back on this morning. Whatever it takes to be right with the Lord, don't delay. Won't you come while we stand and sing together?